That was a very impressive introduction, and I very much hope I can live up to it in this talk. So thank you also to you all for coming to this enclosed, very nice room, but sixth floor room on such a beautiful evening as this. Really appreciate you being indoors. So my talk is called Art Speak. Art Speak is an unflattering term for the dense, sometimes jargon-filled. Hello, can you hear me all right?
No.
No.
Before you get into flow,
of course. Okay, there is a microphone option that I can switch to. Shall I have another go at audibility, natural audibility? And if that doesn't work, wave at me again and we'll switch. Does that sound good? Okay, I'll be looking at the back row. So art speak is an unflattering term for the sort of language used by some people, especially art critics and other professional art appreciators of various kinds, in their attempts to elucidate what a given piece of art is really about, the sort of deep, real, genuine, underlying meaning of a piece of art. And the complaint that's baked into this derogatory term is one that really chimes with me, that really sort of, I feel that I've experienced in my own repeated attempts at interaction with art as an absolute non-expert in art. And that is that I can feel myself to be in the presence of an artwork that is, as Fabienne just naturally put it, that's speaking to me, metaphorically speaking, that seems to be conveying something to me of great importance or significance. And yet, any attempt to verbalize what it is that the artwork is saying to me, metaphorically speaking, whether my own attempts at verbalization or sort of reading the description card in an art gallery, can not only leave me cold, but can even do something worse than that. It can leave me feeling sort of distanced or alienated from the artwork because I simply don't recognize in that verbal description of the artwork what it is that I actually feel the art is doing to me when I'm letting myself be sort of immersed in the art. And that sort of experience of mismatch or a gap between what I feel the art is conveying to me on the one hand and a sort of failure to get a grip on the meaning of artwork through articulations or even sort of articulations to oneself, so sort of trying to get at that meaning for one's own satisfaction. That's the subject matter of today's talk. How am I doing in the back? Is it okay? Thanks. In the written version of this material, I lean on a literary example where there's a character described as being in a situation just like this. But in today's talk, I'm not going to draw on that literary example. I'm just going to use a personal example of my own from relatively recent past, just so we have an example on the table to sort of work with. So it was probably 18 months ago or so, I went to Somerset House to see an exhibition of Frank Auerbach heads, some charcoal sketches. And on these slides, I've included some of the Auerbach heads so that you can get a bit of a sense as you go through the talk of the sort of aesthetic experience that I was going through as I was going around the exhibition. It's quite a small exhibition, a sort of small room. And as you can see already from the image on the title slide, these heads are sort of gnarled, contorted, slightly haunting human faces, some of them like this one, sort of looking away as if beyond the limits of this world, some of them looking directly towards you, some of them sort of can't quite locate where the eyes are looking at all. So the effect of standing in the middle of this room with these faces hung at eye height all around you, I felt to be very, very powerful indeed. I felt as if this art was conveying something to me, was pressing in on me, something significant, something important, something that I sort of ought to take notice of. But I'd gone to this exhibition with a friend who happens to be terribly erudite, and as I turned to him and tried to explain to him what I felt that I was getting from this artwork, all this artistic potency in the experience just immediately collapsed into an utterly embarrassing slump of, you know, just evidently inadequate words and phrases that were clearly not getting at the real meaning that I felt to be sort of pressing in on me from this artwork. Okay, so that's an experience of my own. I'm hoping I'm not completely special in having these sorts of experiences, that some of you will have had something like the same experience yourself. But in the spirit of using philosophy as therapy, I'm going to use our collective time over the next 2 hours to absolve myself of the embarrassment that I felt that day. So that's the aim of the talk. So that's the target phenomenon of the talk. But I've just given it to you in quite a kind of case-driven presentation, a bit of a loosey-goosey way. So next, let me just tighten that up into a target phenomenon that we can really work with. So the first thing to say is that the phenomenon I've just given you is a phenomenological phenomenon. I've just described to you a particular experience or kind of experience that one can have when engaging with art. And this experience is characterized by two identifiable components. The first is an experience as of profundity, as of being in the presence of profound or important contents coming from the art. But that's paired in these sorts of experiences with a feeling of these very profound contents that one feels oneself to be in the presence of as being inaccessible to one. So there's a kind of lack of access to the very profound contents that you feel are sort of pressing in on you from the art. And I should say that I've used the example of visual art, but this is a phenomenon that I think can happen across different art forms. So your personal experience might be in a different art form, but I take it to be a sort of broad sort of phenomenon that cuts across the arts. All right, so that's the target phenomenon in a slightly more tightened up form. Now, as Fabienne's introduction probably indicated, I'm not really a philosopher of art. I'm a philosopher of mind. And to my philosopher of mind ear, the fact that creatures like us, minded creatures like us, who engage in practices of art creation and art engagement, routinely undergo this strange sort of experience that I've just described, that's enough to get my philosophical antennas up. I think that makes it a worthy philosophical object of investigation. But in case that doesn't work for you, let me say something more about why I think this is a philosophically interesting sort of experience that I've just put on the table before us. So in the first instance, as I say, this is an experience that I've described to us. It's a phenomenological phenomenon. But in many domains, we take it that how things seem to us to be is a pretty good guide to how things really are. Unless we have some reason to think otherwise. So what would that mean applied here? Well, it would mean that the subject in question who's undergoing this experience would seem to be undergoing a very strange sort of epistemic episode in cases like the one I've just described. And that's because the subject who's in this position seems to have access to this further layer of content in the artwork. And it's not just that she has access to sort of the existential fact of there being an additional layer of content. She's aware of these contents to the extent that she can recognize something about them. She can see that they are profound or significant or weighty. So she can see something about them. And yet, if the second experiential component is also a good guide to the underlying epistemology, she doesn't have access to these contents at all. So that suggests a very sort of strange underlying epistemology to cases like this. And we can bring out the strangeness of the epistemology with a question like this. If I can access enough of the contents to recognize their profundity, Why can't I access the contents themselves? And I don't think that this is an unanswerable question. It's just that I think it's an interesting one. Okay, so that's the target phenomenon, and that's why I think it's interesting. And now let me tell you what the plan is for the rest of the talk. I'm just going to move the microphone. Is that going to mess anything up? No. Okay, so what I'd really like to talk about in today's talk comes in part three of the talk. So what I really want to get to is a novel proposal that I want to make about a new kind of content that I think we can find or make sense of in art. And then I'll come back quite briefly at the end to saying something about how we can use this novel kind of content to help us make sense of the target phenomenon that I've just started the talk with. But before I get there, I'm going to do some stage setting by mapping out some alternative routes we could have gone in with respect to the target phenomenon. So first, very briefly, I'll raise and reject two somewhat knee-jerk reactions to the phenomenon as I've presented it. In part two, I'll consider a slightly more serious suggestion about how we might make sense of it that's drawing on work by Catherine Elgin and her feature exemplification view. And to anticipate, I'm going to say that I really like Elgin's view, but that I wonder whether it doesn't go far enough. So the discussion of Elgin in part two will be a sort of on-ramp to the proposal that I really want to make in this talk in section three. All right, so that's the plan. Given the way that I've characterized the target phenomenon, so just to remind ourselves, that's an experience that's made up of these two components, an experience as of being in the presence of profundity, and an experience of those profound contents being inaccessible, inaccessible to me. And then with this idea that we'd sort of, unless we have good reason to think otherwise, we'd like that to be a good guide to what the underlying epistemology is of the subject situation. Given that way of setting up the target phenomenon, there are two moves we could pull to debunk the underlying uneasy epistemology that I've just introduced, which is that we could, in either case of those two experiential components, say that either one is not really a good guide to how things are epistemically speaking with the subject. So this is what those two moves would look like. We could either deny that there are really any deep contents in art, which would be a denial that there's any content in art that goes beyond the surface representational content in a piece of art, so beyond the contents of the sentences in a novel, beyond what's represented by the images in a representational painting, and so on and so on. Those surface representational contents are fine, but the person who's endorsing this first move won't accept any further layer of content in art. The second debunking move is to say, no, there really are these deep contents in art, but there's nothing sort of interesting or principled about a subject's lack of access to those contents. It doesn't reveal anything insightful or interesting about the kind of contents that we're dealing with, these contents like any other that are there for the taking. It's just sometimes, like any other kinds of contents, the subject can underperform or be limited by her own personal imperfections or lack of requisite capacities, be having an off day. In that house in Somerset House, maybe I was just having a personal off day and I failed to access the contents, but the contents were there for the taking. So those are the two sorts of debunking moves that I have in mind. And there are reasons why one might be attracted to either one of these moves. So with respect to the first debunking move amounts to a kind of skepticism about the existence of deep contents in art. So the first move will probably appeal to those who anyway have an inclination towards sparse ontological commitments. And that sort of ontological modesty pairs well with an off-the-shelf error theory about why we might nevertheless seem to be in the presence of deep contents in art when we're in these kind of situations. The skeptic can just say, look, all you're interacting with are the surface representational contents, the sentences, the contents of the sentences, the images in the painting, and the other formal properties of the art object, the colours, the sounds, the shapes, and so on. But your interaction with those features of the artwork just cause you to have all sorts of thoughts and feelings, which put you in a state of mind which is just as if you're engaging with a further layer of deep content in the artwork. But it's just a causal consequence of engaging with the things on the scene that we can all agree with. The second debunking move seems to me to be a really natural one to take from the individual's perspective when you're actually in this kind of situation. And it's certainly the one that I would have taken that day in Somerset House, the thought that if somebody else was standing in my place in that room, they would be reaping these magnificent epistemic rewards from engaging with these very same pieces of art. But because it's little old me with my personal imperfections, I'm not getting the content, which is just there for the taking for anybody else. So, you know, the second option might appeal to those of us who are inclined towards self-blame in these kinds of situations. And as I said, I'm not going to linger on these first two moves very much at all. All I want to do is emphasize that these are debunking moves. So they resolve the epistemic strangeness of the subject situation by denying that that really is the epistemology of the situation, by denying that either one or other of the experiential components is really tracking how things are, epistemically speaking, with the subject. And that seems fine, maybe, if we can't find a way of accommodating, of giving an account of the target phenomenon that does justice to the surface phenomenology as really tracking how things are with the subject. It seems to me that in the first instance, we should have a go at a more ambitious account that does allow us to preserve this connection with how things seem to be and how things really are. And if we can't do that, then let's keep these moves as fallback options. We can come back to this slide and decide which of these two moves is the more attractive one. So all I'm going to say is let's park them, come back to them if we need to, but I don't think they should be the starting point of our inquiry. Okay. So at this point in the talk, there's a suspicion that might already be hopping up and down in some of your heads about how I've set up the sort of puzzling target phenomenon at the start of this talk, which is that as soon as I started talking about experiencing the presence of profundity, I immediately translated that into talk of the presence of profound contents and access or lack of access to contents. And in most areas of philosophy of mind and language, when we talk about contents, what we're really talking about are propositional contents, or contents that are individuated by truth conditions, maybe accuracy conditions, and that are carried by sort of representational vehicles like words and sentences. But if this is the sort of content that I have in mind, then it really might seem as if I've stacked the rhetorical deck in favor of thinking of this additional layer of content as being something really mysterious or even maybe impossible seeming. And that's because I've already defined deep artistic content as content that goes beyond the surface representational content of a given piece of art. But if we're thinking of this further layer of content as being content of the same kind as the surface representational content and carried by the same representational vehicles at the surface of the art object, then we're asking those vehicles to do double duty, to determine a surface layer of representational content and also this sort of further deep, meaningful layer of artistic content. And that looks like a very difficult thing to do, maybe an impossible thing to do. But is this a trap? Did I need to set things up in that way? And if this is a suspicion that's been hopping up and down in your head, then be assured that I'm really sympathetic with that sort of complaint. And indeed, my own proposal that I'm going to put on the table later on in this talk is one in which I'm going to try and move us away from this propositional model of content in art. I'm going to try and hold on to the content bit, though. I'm not the first person to have noticed that propositional content is a very restrictive notion of content to try and capture all the sorts of content that you might want to when it comes to talking about art. So there's a few different people I could have spoken about here, but the person I want to talk about is Catherine Elgin and her feature exemplification view. So Elgin posits a kind of content in art that's not propositional, that's not truth apt, so definitely not truth conditionally individuated. Instead, for Elgin, artworks contain features that exemplify themselves. So this is on the model of a paint swatch, a familiar example. So let's say this is a paint swatch. The idea is that this object has some features, or at least one feature, namely its color, that serves as a salient sample of itself. It has other features that don't play this role. So the size of this paint swatch, the weight of this paint swatch, its distance from the Eiffel Tower, as Elgin says, all of these things don't serve as salient samples of themselves. And for Elgin, what this means is that they don't stand in this self-exemplification relation. Okay, so here she is in her own words. Exemplification is a mode of reference. So it's not just that these features exemplify themselves. What Elgin says is when they exemplify themselves, that turns it into a form of reference. Exemplification is a mode of reference by which an object highlights some of its own features. It brings them to the fore. An exemplar is thus not just an instance of the features it exemplifies, it's a symbol that refers to them. Okay, so I'm gonna give some examples because that's somewhat dense as it stands. So the sorts of examples she has in mind split into two camps. Elgin thinks that this sort of exemplification can happen either in cases of literal feature exemplification or in cases of metaphorical feature exemplification. So for literal feature exemplification, one example that she talks about a lot is Jackson Pollock. So this is the sort of splatters of paint paintings. And she says the viscosity of the paint on the canvas in these Pollock paintings stand in this exemplification relation to themselves. They stand as salient samples of viscosity, the feature of viscosity. Or another case that falls on the literal side that was suggested to me that I quite liked was a poem can be literally cyclical in structure. But this can be a feature of the poem that stands in this exemplification relation to itself because it can bring structural cyclicity, that's not a word, structural, a cyclical structure to the fore, highlight a cyclical structure as applying to the subject matter of the poem. Okay, so those are literal examples of how this sort of account is supposed to work. And here's a metaphorical example. So another Auerbach head. This head is not literally ghoulish. It's not literally made of ghostly matter, but it's metaphorically ghoulish. And its ghoulishness can play the same role for Elgin. It can self-exemplify, and in so doing, turn into a mode of reference to ghoulishness. Okay, so that's a sort of lightning sketch of Elgin's view, or at least as much of it is going to be relevant to our purposes today. What should we make of it? So in her negative ambitions, I'm just completely on board. It seems completely right to me that we should move away from confining ourselves to propositional contents when it comes to trying to understand all the sorts of contents that we can find in art. And in the details of her account too, I just really like her account, and I think something like this surely must happen. There surely must be, there maybe not must be, but it seems very plausible to me that there is this kind of exhibition of some of the features of an artwork that can draw our attention to it in just the sort of way that Elgin suggests in her account. On the other hand, it seems to me that Elgin has moved us away from one highly circumscribed notion of content, so just thinking that the only resource we can look to is propositional content, to another very confined notion of content, namely just these punctate features, the cyclical structure or viscosity, ghoulishness. And that's because the exemplification relation that she's interested in ranges over features of artworks. Okay. Why has she done this? Why has she moved from one limited notion of content in art to another alternative but also limited notion of content in art? Well, part of the story here is that it seems limited to me because of the theoretical aims that I have in today's talk. I'm interested in understanding these deep contents in art that can seem to strike us when we're in the presence of these artworks. And it seems to me that these punctate features seem a little limited as a palette out of which we might want to construct the sort of deep content that we might feel ourselves to be faced with. But that's not what Elgin is doing. Elgin's not interested in the question of deep content in art, at least in the pieces of work that I've been looking at. What Elgin is doing is giving a systematic account, what I'm calling here an encoded content account, which is in the business of giving a systematic story about how particular formal properties of the art object come to be associated with particular meaning properties. And for Elgin, this kind of systematic association between formal properties and meaning properties happens through the operation of exemplification. But you know, in order to give a full account of that, she'll have to say what that operation ranges over. And for her, it ranges over features. So her sort of specificity in what it is that can stand in this self-exemplification relation is a virtue of her account, given the theoretical agenda that she's speaking to. She's just giving a full, specific, detailed, encoded content view, as I'm describing it here. Okay, but you know, her theoretical agenda is not mine. So it may be that what isn't overly limiting for her agenda might feel somewhat limiting to my agenda. Okay, so the take-home lessons from that discussion are, firstly, that I think we should go along with Elgin in continuing to move away from just confining ourselves to propositional content when we're thinking about modeling deep artistic content. But it seems to me that we ought to have ambitions to move further still in terms of liberalizing the sort of components out of which we can construct the deep artistic contents that feature in the sort of experiences that I described at the beginning of this talk. So I like her view, but I wonder if just restricting ourselves to features of contents of artworks isn't going to be as kind of liberalizing as we might want for the sort of ambition that I've set on the table. Okay, so that's the Elgin view. There's actually one last thing that I want to say about the Elgin view before introducing my own proposed account that I'm going to call the ostensive account of deep artistic contents. And that is one thing that I really like about the Elgin view is that it allows us to take seriously a way of talking that I've found very natural throughout this presentation, namely that we can feel ourselves to be in the presence of profundity. And for Elgin, as I said, she's not in the business of giving an account of deep content in art, but if she was, or if we took up her machinery and used it to construct an account of deep content in art, we would be able to take that talk of presence in a non-metaphorical, perfectly literal sense. And that's because her exemplification account has the kind of novel sort of content she has on the table, exhibiting itself, perceptually speaking. Those features are just there for us to perceive in the ordinary sense of the term. It's just that then in our interpretation of it, correct interpretation of it, we take those perceivable properties to be standing in this special self-exemplification relation. And so an Elgin-inspired deep content account would allow us to really talk about the presence of profundity seriously. But notice that perceptual presence isn't the only kind of presence that we might countenance here. Another kind of presence is not perceptual presence, but non-perceptual attentional presence. So, you know, I can attend to things perceptually in the room, I can draw our attention to a particular object in our shared perceptual environment, but I can also attend to things outside our shared current perceptual environment. I can attend to the details of my train trip home tomorrow, for instance. And what I want to do over the next few slides is present an account of deep content in art that privileges not perceptual attention, sorry, perceptual presence as it would be on the Elgin account, but non-perceptual attentional presence. So that's the sort of spirit of the account that I'd like to now give. And the way I'm going to give it is that first I'm just going to tell you what it is in its tightest formulation that I can manage. And then over the next couple of slides, I'll give some clarifications and some caveats. And I'm hoping that through discussion of those clarifications and caveats, sort of the fullness of the account will come to the surface. All right, so here's the view. Deep artistic content, so that's the posit that we've been talking about so far throughout the talk. Deep artistic content consists in, so it's a metaphysical claim, what is ostended, for now think of that as a kind of fancy word for pointing, by the art maker who's created this object of ostension. So deep artistic content consists in what is ostended by the art maker. And the sort of very basic idea behind this account is that there's a fundamental that-ness in the deep content of art. What is the deep content of art? It's that. Whatever your attentional gaze is in a constrained way directed towards as a result of successful engagement with the art object. Okay. So we can say a little more than ostension is fancy pointing. I'm taking ostension to be an act of interpersonal attention guidance. As you might have anticipated, given the way that I introduced the account, it comes with the starting selling point that, like the Elgin-inspired view, this view allows us to take this talk of presence of profundity seriously, this time not because the content is carried by something which is perceptually present, but rather because the content is something that is literally present to mind. So it's presence to mind in this case. Just to be explicit about what I take myself to be offering this literature, the most important novelty of the proposal that I'm making is a shift in how we think of the art object as carrying its content. So rather than thinking of it in the sort of encoded content view, like the Elgin view that we saw a couple of slides ago, the content is what falls under our attentional gaze. So to put this in metaphorical terms, this is a shift from the traditional metaphor of thinking in terms of the formal properties, so shapes, colors, sounds, and so on, serving as the vehicles of content, to them serving as pointers towards content. That's the sort of big shift that I'd like to try out with this proposal. Not just anything goes, so it can't be that just anything that I end up attending to as a result of engaging with an art object can get to count as part of its deep content. I could engage with an art object, find it very boring, and end up thinking about what I'm going to have for lunch. But it can't be that, you know, lunch gets into the deep content of this artwork. So what's the principle of constraint? Well, here come back again to the perceptual case. So in the case of pointing to an object in our shared environment, I can draw all of your attention to a particular object in the room. And there are going to be differences in what you all end up perceptually attending to as a result of my ostension. And there's going to be perspectival differences. Perhaps some of you are a bit blocked from view. But there's also going to be a great deal of overlap, resulting in a kind of recognizable range of contents. And this is the sort of model of constraint that I want to carry over into the art case too. So in the case of art, I'd like the principle of constraint that determines what the what gets into the deep content and what counts as a case like the lunch case that falls outside the proper range. I want that constraint to be determined by a kind of reasonable range of expected public alignment. So if many other people were standing in similar conditions to me, engaging with the same artwork, there would be, again, a kind of reasonable range of contents that we would expect to find in all those viewers. Okay, so that's the view, and now here are the clarifications. And I've left the formulation of the view up there at the top of the slide in case it's helpful to have it. So there are at least three things I owe you by way of clarification. What is ostended? So what are the proper targets of ostension? What are the mechanisms of ostension? And what is it for something to fall in the ostension range of the art maker? And with this one, I'm interested in sort of speaking to the final clause of the variation. Why have we brought in talk of the art maker at all? And I'll take these each in turn. So first, what are the proper targets of ostension? Well, as I'm using the term, ostension is nothing over and above an act of interpersonal attention guidance. So when we ask about the proper targets of ostension, we quickly start asking about the proper targets of attention, non-perceptual attention. And I take it that the answer to that question is going to be vast. There's very few things that we can't attend to in thought. There's very few metaphysical category restrictions on what we can attend to. We can attend to concrete particulars, to objects and their properties, to events and processes and states and abstract objects, and merely possible states of affairs and impossible states of affairs. We can attend to the internal structure of things, whether that's propositional structure or otherwise. We can attend to other sorts of relations between things, and so on and so on. Indeed, we might think that there's going to be very little, except perhaps for the exception of perfectly private sensations, that falls within the scope of effability that doesn't fall in the scope of potential ostension in this non-perceptual attention sense. Okay, so what is ostended? The answer is vast, pretty much anything. And notice here that I'm paying up on my promise from the Elgin discussion to try and liberalize the sorts of resources we would have out of which to make up these deep artistic contents that we can sometimes feel ourselves to be in the presence of. All right, so that's clarification one. What are the mechanisms of ostension? How do we ostend? Again, the answer here is going to be vast. So in the case of ostension in a shared perceptual environment, pointing is the canonical mechanism of ostension. But you know, even in just very naturalistic settings, it's not always going to be me using my finger. It might be me using my elbow or a bump of the hips or a tilt of the head. Or we might use a sort of arrow drawn up on a whiteboard behind me. We might just meaningfully pause as the person we were talking about walks into the room. So there's all sorts of things that can work as mechanisms of ostension. In the written version of this material, I call ostension a whatever works notion. And it seems to me that just creatures like us are extremely flexible and sensitive in knowing what sort of thing is going to work in a given context for drawing one another's attention to the thing that we want to make salient. And a modest way of putting the proposal that I want to make today is I just think artworks should be added to this long list. That in addition to all these other ways we can sometimes manipulate each other's attention, we can also do it through art, is a sort of another way of putting the proposal I want to make. Okay, so mechanism of ostension, again, very vast. Still though, you might be wondering, yes, but how do the mechanisms work in art in particular? So in the representational art forms, it might be that the surface representational contents do a lot of heavy lifting here in drawing our attention to particular subject matters. But differences in the ways in which the different sorts of art forms draw our attention will make a big difference to the quality and nature of the attention as it lands there. What about the non-representational art forms like pure music? Well, there's a sort of cottage industry of models available in the market for how pure instrumental music can come to be about anything beyond itself. So it could be that the music mimics the cadences and intonation patterns of human vocalizations of emotions. It might be that there's the creation of a musical persona who is the bearer of meaning. It could be that there's a kind of experiencing as, a metaphorical experiencing as, into the music when we listen to it, and so on and so on. There are various different models available. And for the purposes of my account, these are not in competition. In fact, it seems plausible to me that there are different operations like this live in different cases, or there could be multiple such operations live in a particular performance of a piece of art, a piece of music. The reason these are not in competition with each other for the purposes of my account is because my content is whatever our attentional gaze lands on as a result of whichever of those mechanisms happen to be live in the given art form. And I think across the spectrum of the arts, there are going to be many weird and wonderful ways in which art objects can do this. Okay, so that's clarification two. Clarification three, what is it for something to fall in the ostension range of the art maker? So in the first instance, I've included mention of the art maker in order to restrict our attention to, art objects that have been created by the art maker in such a way that they're well suited to serve as these mechanisms of ostension. And to state the obvious, not all art is made in such a way. There's a lot of art that's just decorative or pleasing to the ear and so on and so on. Not all art needs to be deep art. Emphatically, what I'm not doing is bringing in any strong intentionalist assumption whereby the ostensive content, as I'm thinking of it, needs to feature in the art maker's creative intentions as she's making the art object. And just to spell out a little bit what I mean by that rejection. Take the parallel case of a conversation. So you and I can have a conversation in which you convey to me a pretty well-rounded sense of how you take some portion of the world to be. But it might be that there's only a very small amount of that information that gets through in virtue of the intentional utterances on your part. And a great deal of it just slips through in virtue of your unreflective choice of phrasing, perhaps the bits of the conversation where you have great fluency and the bits of the conversation where you find yourself hesitating and searching for the words, where in the conversation you can hold my gaze and where you sort of can't hold my gaze, and so on and so on. So there are all sorts of unintended ways in which you can let slip your vision of the world, but that vision of the world still comes from you. It still has you as its source. And I think that's important to recognize. And it's just something like that that I want to say about the art maker, which is why I've included this final caveat here. So the ostensive content doesn't need to be part of the intentions of the art maker as she's making the art object, but she might let slip through all sorts of ostensive content with her still as its source. The art object is the way it is because she made it that way. It's not just a trick of the light or a gust of wind. And I just think it's sort of important to recognize that when we're talking about art. Okay, so those are my three clarifications. We're almost there, but I've just got one more clarification that I owe you before wrapping things up. So when I began this talk, I began with some quite lofty ideas about trying to better understand the deep content in art in terms of the significant content or the weighty content or important content. But what we seem to have ended up with is an account of deep content in art which seems almost quasi-spatial or layering. I've told us what it is to have deep content in art in the sense of content that outstrips its surface representational content. But do those two things necessarily all come together, or have I just started off with the promise of something quite lofty and then got to the end of the talk and settled for something relatively modest? So let me, the final clarification about the account is to tell you about how I take these two senses of profundity to connect on the account that I'm proposing. So I've been using profound in these two senses. I defined deep content in this quasi-spatial sense, according to which a content is profound if it outstrips its surface representational content. But at the beginning, it sounded like I was talking much more about profundity in the significant sense of content that's weighty or important. And the connection that I see between these two senses of profundity on my account is that on the ostensive model, the sort of explosion of what can get into the deep content of an artwork in the spatial sense creates fertile grounds for content which is profound in the significant sense. And here again, I'm very influenced by Catherine Elgin, who really talks a lot about the importance of redrawing lines or reconfiguring domains in order to enrich our grasp of a given domain. And it seems to me that my ostensive account in the kind of quasi-spatial sense creates just these sorts of reconfiguration or redrawing of the lines that's liable to produce novel or disruptive ways of thinking about the subject matter. So that's how I sort of square those two senses of profundity. So yes, officially speaking, this is an account of profundity in the quasi-spatial sense, but I do think that I'm at least providing the groundwork for some profundity in the significant sense. Okay, so back to the target phenomenon. There I was in the Auerbach exhibition, feeling terribly embarrassed about my inability to put into words what it was that I felt this artwork was conveying to me. Should I have felt embarrassed? Well, we end the talk with the happy result that no, I shouldn't have. And that's because on the proposed account, there's perfect sense to be made of being in a situation in which you're making genuine epistemic contact with the deep content of an artwork, and yet for that deep content to lack the kind of structure that could easily be put into words or grasped in an episode of propositional knowledge. And so the fact that I sort of couldn't say what it was that the artwork was doing to me in that situation doesn't undermine my sense that I really was in contact with this deep content of the artwork. And on that happy note of resolution, I'll leave it there.